I want to continue what I've been on before. More of the same, except today we'll get started on a little bit of a different line. I want to begin a discussion of the radioactive dating methods. All right. Well, today I want to begin the discussion of radioactive dating methods, but before I do, let me tell you one more indicator of a young age for things. Then I'm going to use carbon-14 to indicate the age of the atmosphere, and then we'll be into radioactive dating methods proper, you might say. I told you yesterday about the magnetic field of the Earth and how it seems to be decaying, and what this indicates regarding the age of the Earth. I want to talk a little bit about the magnetic field, but from a different angle today. When lavitic rock pours out on the surface of the Earth, say associated with some volcano flow or something of that nature, the particles in these rocks, this lavitic rock, act like a small compass. Got one of those particles? The particle itself will act like a little compass needle. And when the rock pours out on the surface of the Earth, those particles that make up the lavitic rock will align themselves just like compass needles will when brought into a magnetic field. Have you ever, perhaps you performed this little experiment, maybe you haven't, but if you take a magnet, and a bar magnet, you cover it with a piece of tissue paper, and take some iron filings and sprinkle them out, you know, on the paper over the bar magnet, you know, those little pieces of iron will all align themselves in a particular way. As a matter of fact, they'll align themselves like a compass would, a compass needle would. The iron filings themselves act as if they were small compass needles. Well, the particles in this lavitic rock act in exactly the same fashion. When the lavitic rock pours out on the surface of the Earth, say out of a volcano or something of this nature, a flow of some sort or other, whether it's a volcano or something else, the particles in the rock align themselves up with the magnetic field of the Earth that's existing at that time. And then the rock solidifies, and the geophysicist says that the field then is frozen into the lavitic rock. You say that the field is frozen. Now, the word frozen is not to be taken literally. The temperature, of course, is not a freezing temperature, but it's a solidifying temperature for one of these, for the different kinds of rocks that may be of this nature. Now, if a geophysicist comes along sometime later, digs out a chunk of that rock, or a geologist, and looks at it, he can, if the rock hasn't changed its position any, he can say, well, the direction of the magnetic field was such and such at some time in the past. Now, if the rock may have changed its position, then there's no way of saying for sure what the direction of the field was. But if the rock hasn't moved since the time that it was deposited, then the direction that the alignment that those particles have, the direction of the alignment of those particles, will tell him the direction of the magnetic field that existed at the time the rock was deposited. But if there's been a tectonic movement, faulting, some kind of movement, any kind of movement, maybe the rock, chunk of rock was broken off and moved to a different position. If the position of the rock has changed any, then of course there's no way to say what the direction of the field was at the time the rock was deposited. Now, I'm not interested really in that angle of the problem. Oh, I'm interested in it, but not for this morning. The people who talk about continental drift, the idea got its start, again, from this frozen magnetic field business, because they say that they can trace the movement of the magnetic pole by looking at these rocks. They say if you look at rock in one vicinity, and rock in some other vicinity, and this kind of rock in some other locality, that you notice there is a different direction for the magnetic field. And supposedly it's come from, the pole has moved from somewhere down in the Pacific Ocean and wandered around up until to where it is today. Well, as I say, I'm not really so interested in that aspect of the problem, but I'm interested in something else. This field that's frozen into the rock is called the natural remanent magnetism of the rock. The natural remanent, R-E-M-A-N-E-N-T, the natural remanent magnetism of the rock. Now, I'm interested in that. Now, when the geophysicist first studied this, he believed that that natural remnant magnetism, which seems to be the same thing as what is called thermal remnant magnetism, he believed that those quantities remain constant with time, that that chunk of rock didn't lose its magnetism once it got it. I don't know why, really, that was ever believed, because ordinarily a magnet will lose its strength, depending on the properties of the material and the strength of the field that causes the magnetic field to be induced in the magnet. But anyhow, they said, and still do say, in many textbooks, that the natural remnant magnetism does not change with time, but remains constant with time. Well, it turns out, at least on the basis of work by some geophysicists, that this is not so, that the natural remnant magnetism decays or gets weaker and weaker as time goes on. A Japanese geophysicist by the name of Nagata, in his book Rock Magnetism, says that the natural remnant magnetism associated with this lebedic rock will decrease with time. And others maintain that this is so. Now, if we can find out the rate at which the magnetism decays, and if we can come to some conclusion or some agreement as to how large a magnetic field could exist in the first place, then maybe we can decide how old the rocks are that have this natural remnant magnetism associated with them. This is the angle I'm wanting to look at. Well, Nagata says that the decay of the natural remnant magnetism of this lebedic rock is an exponential decay, similar to the decay of a radioactive mineral with a half-life. And he says that the half-life varies from 5,000 years to 10,000 years. Now, he gives that value for the half-life on the basis of ages given to rocks by the evolutionist. So these are large half-lives because they have to do with the evolutionist concept of time and what has taken place in the past. And they're not likely to be right for that reason, since I've already surely, well, you may not agree with me anyhow, pointed out some reasons I don't think they're right, at least. Believe it as you want to. Suit yourself. Well, anyhow, it's believed that one of these chunks of rock with natural remnant magnetism associated with it could not go through more than 10 half-lives until the field is so weak that it could not be measured today. Now, you see what that, of course, means is the geophysicist is assuming that the planet can hold only a certain size magnetic field. And I talked about this yesterday. Well, I think that is reasonable, probably. But anyhow, that's the assumption, of course, that's involved when you say it can't go through more than 5 to 10 half-lives. Let's say 10 half-lives. We'll give them benefit of the doubt on this thing. We'll say 10 half-lives. That after 10 half-lives of decay of this natural remnant magnetism, you couldn't measure it. There wouldn't be enough left because, you see, with a half-life, that means every, say, 5,000 years or 10,000 years, whichever value you take as a half-life, the strength of that natural remnant magnetism has been cut down to one-half of what it was at the beginning of that interval. Well, let's see what this means, then. All sedimentary rock, by that I mean all types of sedimentary rock, not all sedimentary rock, I said that poorly, but all types of sedimentary rock have this lebedic rock somehow associated with it through tectonic movements, through geological occurrences in the past, so that all sedimentary rock, then, all types of sedimentary rock, have natural remnant magnetism indirectly associated with them. Cambrian rock in some localities has lebedic rock associated with it. The lebedic rock poured out or was deposited at the same time that the Cambrian rock was. That's what I mean by saying that they're geologically intimately related. That means if I say King Ordovician rock, for instance, has a natural remnant magnetism associated with it. I mean, it has a Levitic rock that was deposited at the same time that it was, that it was formed. At least this is the geologist's concept. And so far as the dynamics of the movement of the rocks, this is so. But I dispute the time factor. Of course, those names, Cambrian, Ordovician, and so forth, have purely a taxonomic meaning to me, and not a time value. Well, anyhow, you have this kind of rock associated with all the types of sedimentary rock, Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, and so forth, right up the line, Triassic, Jurassic, and so forth, finally down to Pleistocene. All of these types of rock have a Levitic rock associated with them that possesses a natural remnant magnetism. Now, what I'm getting at is this. If, and this is the statement of the geophysicist, who is uniformitarian in his outlook, if the natural remnant magnetism, let's say, can go through only 10 half-lives, then the age of any of those rocks, at the most, that have a natural remnant magnetism, is what? Either 100,000 years, if you take the 10,000-year value as the half-life of the natural remnant magnetism, or 50,000 years, at the most, if you take the lower value of 5,000 years as the half-life. So what I'm saying is, then, there is no kind of Levitic rock that can be older at the most than 100,000 years or 50,000 years at the most, whichever value you want to take. And as I certainly feel that both values are wrong, for that matter. But anyhow, for my argument, you can take their value. It'll be fine. Now, what I'm saying is, Levitic, L-A-V-I-T-I-C, just old lava soap. You heard of lava soap, scrub it, and you won't have any skin left. You use it. Well, all of the sedimentary layers, by that I mean all types of them, now not all sedimentary layers, but all types that the geologist has classified, going from their so-called oldest, the Cambrian, down to their so-called youngest, the Pleistocene, and then they have what is referred to as the recent. All of these have this kind of rock or natural remnant magnetism associated with them. I'm saying, then, that there is no sedimentary layer, then. The Cambrian cannot be older than 100,000 or 50,000 years, because if it were, the natural remnant magnetism would be gone and would not be measurable. So if that is the case, that the Cambrian can't be older than that, then the fossils can't be older than that. And the fossils are the remains of plants and animals that existed in the past here on the earth. They cannot be older. The plants and animals can't be older than that. And this talk of millions of years becomes absurd, which I've already indicated that I think it's absurd from other indications. But how can anything be older than the natural remnant magnetism? You see what I'm getting at? You have a magnet that has a particular strength. That in at the most, in 100,000 years, would lose that strength so it could not be measured with your best magnetometer. Still, you have nice, strong, natural remnant magnetism, healthy and young-looking, associated with all of the sedimentary rocks, all the types of sedimentary rock. So what I'm saying is, the fossils in those sedimentary layers cannot go back past, at the most, 50,000 or 100,000 years. Yes. Well, I don't know why he did, and he recognized the problem. Dr. Melvin Cook from the University of Utah met a man by the name of Sharon, a geophysicist from Washington University in St. Louis, and he met him up in the mines, uranium mine, and Sharon has worked on this problem, and Cook asked Sharon about this problem. How things could be old geologically if the natural remnant magnetism was decaying so rapidly. And Sharon said, well, it's a real problem. We don't know the answer on it. He said, Nagata will be over here this fall. That was in 1969. And he said, Nagata recognizes the problem too. He said, when he gets here, you can ask him what he thinks about it. So certainly the problem was recognized, but a physicist, I suppose, feels like he has to some extent, be honest. Now and then tell the truth, once in a while, about matters. So he went ahead anyhow with those values, even though it has very serious geological implications, of course, obviously. But of course, the whole thing is ignored. Have you read about it in the newspapers? No. But you can find what I've told you on one page in Nagata's book, Rock Magnetism. You can find his equation for the decay and the exponential decay. Yes. Well, there are some geophysicists who are still writing in their books that it doesn't change with time. Strangway, for instance, at Toronto. Oh, he's now down in Houston with NASA. And a fellow by the name of Tarling, a British physicist, still had it in his book. But most geophysicists, I'd say today, consider that it does change with time. Well, roughly whatever the field was existing on the Earth at that time. Well, if you could decide for sure when the Earth started, then you could, or when the rocks were formed. It's hard to say when a flow occurred, as a matter of fact, because probably a lot of your flows occurred during the flood action. I believe there were tremendous changes in the crust. I personally feel that most of the water involved in the flood came from the crust, rather than the atmosphere. Certainly some came from the atmosphere. They talked about the rains pouring down. But I believe the major portion of the water came from the crust itself. At least the reference is there to the fountains of the deep. There seems to have been a great instability in the crust of the earth. And I think most of your water came from the crust off the earth rather than from the atmosphere. But it's practically impossible, I think, to date any of these flows. I mean, be able to assign a physical date. I guess you concluded that I don't put much stock in any dating method, which is true. There are too many assumptions in them for anybody to try. Creationist or evolutionist, yes. No, I haven't. But that's what he bases those on. And perhaps if some work were really done on that, be an entirely different value there, I think. I think it probably would be smaller, because it's based on evolutionary presuppositions, which always means they're taking as much as they can get. And a lot more, for that matter. As much as they can figure they can get by with. No. Well, some have more magnetism than others do, but there's no systematic pattern. Just scatters about. Really a scatter. By that I mean sometimes the Cambrian rock may have more than the Cretaceous. Sometimes the Cretaceous rock may have more than the Cambrian. So it's a scatter thing, not systematic. Surely. Mm-hmm. Yes. The susceptibility of the rocks themselves, yes. Well, one more egg in the whole thing. Let's take a look at some other things. Creationists have avoided this question of time far too long. So much evidence, really, for a young Earth. It's amazing. Not really amazing, but amazing in a sense. It's too bad creationists shied away from this question for so many years and left it to the uniformitarians. Because there's a great deal of evidence for a young age, and certainly that seems to be one that is hard to refute, at least to me. It seems rather hard to refute. But anyhow, let's take a look today at carbon-14 to start with. We'll begin there. I want to look at it first, because it will give us a way of getting an age for the atmosphere, I maintain. If we can get an age for the atmosphere, then we've got an age for everything that breathes, or breathed. Because you can't breathe without an atmosphere, can you? So, and you may not be able to breathe even with one. If you get down on Venus, where it's mainly carbon dioxide, you may have some trouble anyway, even with an atmosphere. Well, let me tell you how the carbon-14 method works, and then I want to criticize it some, and discuss it a bit, and see what it really implies about the age of things. Now, carbon-14 is an unstable form of carbon. It's an isotope of carbon. Now, an isotope of an element is, for instance, if you say you have an isotope of carbon, it means that you can have two carbon atoms that have the same electrical properties. By that I mean the same electronic charge, same chemical properties, but they have a different number of neutrons in their nuclei, which makes one heavier than the other. But two elements that have the same chemical or electrical properties represent the same element. But if you have a different number of particles in the nuclei, they're both isotopes. They have, you see, a different weight, so to speak. The nucleus is not involved in chemical reactions, at all. It's only the electrons that are involved in the chemical reactions. And that determines the naming of the element. The nuclear property, well, the nuclear properties have to do with the mass of the nucleus in particular. Well, carbon-14 is an isotope of carbon, the carbon atom. And it's an unstable form, which means that spontaneously or otherwise, whatever the cause of decay is, if you leave a bunch of carbon atoms sitting around, they'll change into something else due to changes in the nuclei of the carbon-14 atoms. Now, what causes those changes? No one knows. Particles and energy are emitted out of that nucleus, and the nucleus changes. It's said to be changing spontaneously. That's what most nuclear physicists believe, is a spontaneous change. What causes it to change spontaneously? All different people have suggested ideas, but nobody has ever remotely been satisfied as to what could cause an atom to just change of its own accord, so to speak. And maybe it doesn't really change spontaneously. Maybe there are effects such as cosmic radiation that have a lot more to do with the changes in the nuclei than is thought by the physicists. But anyhow, the textbooks say that these are atoms that change spontaneously into something else. So I'm not going to argue around about how they change, since I haven't the slightest idea what causes them to change in the first place. But a carbon atom is unstable. It can changes into nitrogen-14. And it's produced in the atmosphere. Carbon-14 is produced in the atmosphere when cosmic radiation is thought to be a flow of high-speed protons. Now, protons are positively charged particles. Protons zipping through space at very high velocities, similar to the solar wind, for instance. But anyhow, cosmic radiation, wherever it's coming from, the stars, the sun, the center of the galaxy, or wherever it may be coming from, impinges on the upper atmosphere of the Earth. It bumps into a bunch of particles there, and neutrons are created. Now, neutrons are electrically neutral. They don't have a net positive or negative electrical charge. They're neutral. Neutrons are produced in these interactions in the upper atmosphere. Those neutrons collide with nitrogen-14 atoms, and in those collisions, carbon-14 is produced. And that carbon-14 then will decay after an interval of time back into nitrogen-14. This is how the carbon-14 is believed to be produced in the atmosphere of the Earth. Well, if you've got this cosmic radiation pouring in, after a while, you'll get carbon-14 produced. Now, if enough time elapses, the rate of production of the carbon-14 will be the same as the rate of decay of the carbon-14. Now, not at first, will it? It takes the carbon-14, this is a radioactive mineral, it has a half-life, and it'll take it a while to decay into nitrogen-14, about 5,570 years, something like that. They write books to keep all these numbers in, and I'm bad to not remember numbers, just certain numbers. But look it up. I think it's 5570, 5560, somewhere, and they've changed it around some. It doesn't make any difference on that order. Anyhow, it has a half-life, and it's nearly 5,600 years, whatever the value is exactly. It's approximately that, which means it's going to take a while before the rate of destruction of the carbon-14, you see, its transformation into nitrogen-14, will become equal to its rate of production. After a while, this should happen. You should get so much carbon-14 in the atmosphere, so much of it, and it's all the time decaying, you should get your rate of decay then being the same as the rate of production. So, when this state is reached, it's said to be that represent the equilibrium state of carbon-14. The atmosphere is said to be in equilibrium when the rate of production is equal to the rate of decay. Well, or the rate of destruction of the carbon-14. Now, the Earth has been around, they say, 4.5 billion years. So whenever we got an atmosphere, and supposedly we had an atmosphere before any plants and animals ever came into existence, and the atmosphere is made up mainly today of what? Nitrogen? What is it, up close 80% or something like that, or maybe even more? Anyhow, it's mainly nitrogen. Whatever the percentage is, very high, it's mainly nitrogen. And so it means if you have nitrogen available, you can get carbon-14, because surely the cosmic radiation has been pouring in from the beginning. It seems to come from the stars. So you had the cosmic radiation around, and if you're going to have anything, breathing and so forth, you're bound to have had a good, a living at least, you're bound to have had a good bit of nitrogen from the start in your atmosphere. So, carbon-14 must have been produced at the beginning of the atmosphere, I would think, or at least shortly thereafter. You're going to take some evolutionary view of how the atmosphere was formed, whichever way you want to take it. Carbon-14 should have been formed essentially, and the evolutionists would agree, from the beginning of the atmosphere itself, whenever that was. If you want to take the evolutionist viewpoint and consider that the carbon, the atmosphere didn't come until by outgassing of the rocks until late, relatively speaking, in the Earth's history, you're at least going to have to put it 750 million years ago. Suit yourself. I don't mind a bit, because what I've got to say comes sure much shorter than that. Yes, go ahead, Joe. All right. Well, if you want to take it to 750 million years, as the evolutionist would at least have to put the atmosphere, and he's going to have to put it before that, for that matter. But anyhow, at least 750 million years ago, the atmosphere would have had to have been in existence in order to get life. Got to have something around for things to breathe, you know, and to make use of. So, then, the evolutionist says, well, the equilibrium state for carbon-14 was reached a long time ago then. And so then, he says this, and the physicist says this, Libby said this, if, say, something is breathing, man, and living, say, back in Arizona somewhere, old Arizona, and he happens to be down in an arroyo, and rain has occurred up in the mountains, and the water comes pouring down, and he gets drowned. Can't get up on the sides quick enough. He gets drowned and gets buried. And sometime later, so many thousands of years later, our archaeologist is out there, and there's a fellow's bones, some of his bones sticking out of the gravel. And he picks them up, brings them in. If you can measure the amount of carbon-14 in the piece of bone, you see, when he's breathing, the carbon-14 in the air then got transferred to the different parts of his body, whatever the agency is for that transfer. The carbon-14 went here and there in his body. So, if you can measure, Libby said, if you can measure the amount of carbon-14 in the bone, say the piece of bone, and the amount of carbon-14 that should be, that's was there originally, the amount that was in the bone when the fellow got buried, quit breathing, got drowned, and if you know the half-life for carbon-14, or the rate of decay is what it amounts to in the long run, you can make an equation relating carbon-14 in the bone right now, carbon-14 is in the bone when the fellow quit breathing, got drowned, and the decay rates, and time. And he says then, solve the equation for the time. This gives you how long the bone was buried there, or when the exchange, roughly, when the exchange ceased with the atmosphere. Or you can quibble about when the exchange ceased and all that kind of business, but that doesn't amount to anything. That's roughly how it works. Well, Libby got the Nobel Prize for that. That's pretty good, if it were true. Mark Twain said, interesting if true, interesting anyway. So, let's see if it is true. Well, what are the difficulties? Well, the carbon-14, it's not hard to measure the carbon-14 in the bone. That's no difficulty. Just get a chemist in the laboratory to do that. That's the easiest thing. That's the only easy thing in the whole business. And that's fairly easy to measure that. I'm not quibbling with the evolutionist on his measurements of the amounts of carbon-14 in bones and things like that. That's silly to argue over that. That's not where the errors are going to lie. Anyway, that's easy to do. Relatively, it may be a small quantity to measure, but nonetheless, it can be done in the laboratory. Who's worrying about that? Some people, when they attack these people on that, they attack them on things where they're not weak. They're not weak on making their measurements. That's no point of weakness. Silly to hit them on those things. But what is the weakness in it? Well, the first weakness is what I've already mentioned. How do you find out how much carbon-14 was in the bone when the fellow got drowned? If you don't know when he got drowned, and you don't know the concentration of carbon-14 in the atmosphere then, you're in a bit of a fix. Well, of course, since it's assumed that everything was in an equilibrium state, and that state hasn't changed in recent times, the evolutionist says, well, the amount of carbon-14 in the air today is the same as the concentration in the air at the time that the man got drowned. Because he says, after all, look how long things have been around, and carbon-14 certainly could have reached an equilibrium state long, long, long ago. And therefore, and it hasn't changed any at all. The present is the key to the past, he says. And there's not been any changes, at least before 1950. Now, after 1950, they exploded so many atomic and nuclear devices that it may have changed things considerably, and the smokestacks of the factories have been pouring out material at such a rapid rate that things may have changed. So they take the concentration of the carbon-14 before 1950 as their reference, because of man's industrial doings have increased so rapidly since 1950. And there's been the explosion of so many hydrogen bombs by the Russians and the United States and the French and the Chinese. And I don't know if anybody else has one or not, if anybody else does. But anyhow, there have been so many of these exploded that the atmosphere has been changed considerably. And so the geochronologist feels he must not go past 1950, using that as his concentration for carbon-14. But you see his reason. Everything is the same. Therefore, why not use today's value, so to speak, or 1950's value, at least, down to that time? All right? But is this necessarily the case? I told you yesterday about the decay of the magnetic field. If the field is getting weaker, then that means our protection from cosmic radiation is getting weaker. Cosmic radiation, sometimes it's a funny thing. You see this studied in textbooks. Some people think it's a flow of neutrons in space colliding with the nitrogen particles to produce the carbon-14. And they say then, well, our decaying magnetic field will have nothing to do with the production of carbon-14. I don't know where in the world they got the idea of neutrons. Listen, it's protons, charged particles, colliding with particles in the upper atmosphere producing neutrons, and neutrons in turn then colliding with nitrogen-14 particles to produce carbon-14. So the strength of that field has a great deal to do with the influx of cosmic radiation. If the field is getting weaker and weaker and weaker, then the influx of cosmic radiation is getting stronger and stronger and stronger, which is bound to change to some extent the concentration of carbon-14 in the atmosphere. Now, you can think of a multitude of factors, and some of the factors might offset this decaying field. And certainly one can go back to the flood and do some arguing as to what the effects of a canopy and such things will be. But I don't know much about the canopy, what its physical properties were, and it's rather hard to say just what the effect of a canopy would be. Anyway, it'd be a purely descriptive statement and nothing more if one discusses it. Now, also, if much volcanic activity has occurred in the past, this is going to radically affect the nitrogen, which is the raw material thing in the atmosphere that neutrons combined with the nitrogen give you the carbon-14. If the nitrogen content has changed considerably in the atmosphere, this is going to affect the concentration of carbon-14 in the past. Protons, yes. Well, with any atoms, just stray atoms, so to speak, on the outer edge of the atmosphere, in these collisions, neutrons are formed. And from the neutrons, they collide in turn with the nitrogen-14 to produce the carbon-14. So if the field is decaying, and the field is decaying, you could argue about whether it's decayed the same way in the past or not, but it's decaying nonetheless right now. At least all that man has looked at has been decaying. Well, the field getting weaker and weaker, the carbon-14 concentration bound to change, and the field is changing at such a rapid rate, 1,400-year half-life, the carbon-14 concentration is going to change rather radically. See, the strength of the field and the direction of the field, the direction of the field has something to do with where the high-speed particles go when they enter the Earth's atmosphere. They'll tend right now, considering where the magnetic poles are, the high-speed particles will tend to go toward the polar regions rather than the temperate zones. But if the field is weak, you're going to have some particles zipping right on through and reaching the surface pretty well wherever they happen to enter the Earth's atmosphere. You have a strong field, you have protection against those particles, and the direction of the field has something to do with where you have the heavy concentrations of the particles. But anyhow, if the field has been changing, this is bound to affect the carbon-14 content or concentration in the atmosphere, and this in turn will then cause your carbon-14 concentration in the past to be very different from the concentration of carbon-14 in the present. And so, if the uniformitarian starts with the wrong concentration of carbon-14 in his equation, he can throw his dates off quite a great deal. But that's not the end of the story, though. Oh, by the way, recently, a chemist in Chattanooga, Tennessee, has challenged the whole idea of whether the decay rate of carbon-14 is a constant or not. He claims that it's not a constant, that he has evidence from a number of experiments that it's varying. He presented his evidence at the meeting of the American Chemical Society about a year and a half ago or something like that, and created quite a stir, and Libby was there, and nobody had really any objection they could lodge against the experimental evidence that he presented, that the decay rate was not really a constant for carbon-14. We may hear more about that. This will be very important, of course, if we do, because if your clock is running fast or running slow, and you can't tell whether it's running fast or slow, whichever way it's running, then you can't use it as a clock, actually. Well, we'll see what comes out of all that. Well, is carbon-14 in an equilibrium state? I think this is the most important question in regard to all of this. A man by the name of Melvin Cook that I've mentioned already has studied this equilibrium state of carbon-14. Libby, when he first began studying this and proposed its use as a dating method, the carbon-14 clock as a dating method, was very disturbed because he found that there was about a 10 to 15% difference between the rate of production of the carbon-14 and the rate of decay of the carbon-14. But you see, the implication of that is serious. If there is a difference in those two, this would imply that what? That atmosphere hadn't been around long enough for equilibrium to be established. And Libby believed what the geologist was saying, that things are very, very old. He couldn't see why in the world it shouldn't be in a state of equilibrium. It have to be. So Libby said, well, these are just errors in measurement. I'm going to go with the idea that it's in an equilibrium state. And he did so. He set it up. That equation I was telling you about, C equals C sub 0 times e to the minus kt power, that's the equation for the equilibrium state. If you have an equilibrium state for carbon-14 existing, that's its equation. The equation is a bit more complicated. If it's not in an equilibrium state. Yes, and it makes a major change in things if it's not in an equilibrium state. So, Libby said it has to be in an equilibrium state. The geologists say this place is old. And goodness, even if it were 1 million years old, it'd be in equilibrium. Let alone 4.5 billion years that they talk about. So there must be some error, he says, in the measurements. Well, over the years, more and more measurements have been accumulated dealing with this equilibrium or non-equilibrium, whichever is the case. Today, it is maintained by reputable geophysicists such as Suess and Lingenfelter and others that there may be as much a difference as 30% in the rate of production and the rate of decay of the carbon-14. It's being produced faster than its decay, is what they're saying. And there may be a difference of as much as 30%. Varies all the way from about 22% up to around 30% or 32% even. It can get as high as that. Some people have measurements that would say it could be as high as 32% difference. Well, if that's the case, that's a serious matter, isn't it? Instead of Libby's hopes and what he thought was the case maybe being borne out, it has gone in exactly the opposite direction. Better measurements and more measurements have said that the difference is much larger than Libby even noticed in the early data back in the late 40s when he was coming up with this method. All right, what does this mean then? This means that really we can calculate an age for the soil, for the atmosphere, doesn't it? Let's take an analogous situation. Suppose you've got a big sink and it has a drain in the bottom of it, a faucet up at the top. You turn the faucet on and the water pours in so many gallons per minute, just to say, let's say 3 gallons per minute to pick a number. And down through the drain, the water is pouring out, let's say, at the rate of 1 gallon per minute. Now that's a difference in rates of 2 gallons per minute, isn't it? It's coming in 2 gallons per minute faster than it's going out. Coming in 3 gallons per minute, going out at 1 gallon per minute. So 2 gallons per minute then is accumulating, so to speak. Or at least the difference in the rate is that much. Now, after a while, water is going to accumulate in that sink, isn't that right? And if you leave it pouring there long enough, it's going to fill up. Have you ever taken a bath in a tub where the plug, or whatever you call it, you know, that fits down, doesn't fit well? And you turn it on, you turn the water on. Now, you let it run, even though it's leaking out around, you know, these mechanical plugs, these metal ones that you turn some, they fit down. They never fit very well, it seems, in bathtubs, and they always leak. anywhere, in motels or in houses that you live in. In fact, they always leak those kinds. And you know, though, even though the water is leaking out, if you've got the faucet running fast enough, the tub's going to fill up, isn't that right? Try it tonight if you don't believe it. Last night, I left the water running in the tub over the motel too long and ran back in just before it was running out over the edges. But I got to watching some movie last night and overestimated or underestimated how long it'd take for the thing to fill up. But it's leaking out a little bit because then I turned it off and went back in to finish watching. And by the time I got back, a good bit had leaked out, you know, down through the drain. Now, what I'm saying is this. If I wanted to, I wasn't really interested. Since I figured I could estimate it better, I could have calculated how long it would take to fill that tub up, couldn't I? If I could have figured out how much it was leaking out, you know, down around the metal plug, if I could have figured out how much was going out per minute and how much was coming in that faucet per minute, I could have figured, it wasn't worth the trouble, but I could have figured how long it would take that water to come up to the top of the tub, isn't that right, knowing the capacity of the tub. And I could have decided exactly when I should walk back into the bathroom there and turn the water off without having to all of a sudden go running in to see if it was about to run over, which it was. But what I'm getting at is this. The same thing applies in regard to this carbon-14. If it is being produced faster in the atmosphere than it is going into nitrogen-14, you see, disappearing from the atmosphere or just being destroyed, and there's some in the atmosphere, then I can figure out how long it takes to what? Accumulate that much carbon-14, just as I can figure out how long it takes to accumulate a certain amount of water in the bathtub. Isn't that so? That's a simple algebra problem, arithmetic problem. They used to do things like that in arithmetic until they got to talking so much about sets and all that kind of business that has nothing to do with anything, hardly. I have a strong doubt that modern students in mathematics, so much of this set theory that they can solve too many problems that have to do with anything. Maybe it's because I don't know so much about sets. At least, I always like those kind. Well, we can figure out how long it takes to accumulate the carbon-14 in the atmosphere. If we can figure out that, we automatically have what then? The age of the atmosphere, isn't that right? Well, set up an equation. You can do it. It's a differential equation, though. Not quite a simple one, but a differential equation. Integrate it. Putting the limits of integration on as from the time that the atmosphere started down to present time, t sub 0 to t. Integrate the equation, and out it comes. And by the way, it'll be a series form, the equation will, when you integrate it. And solve them for the length of time that it takes to accumulate the amount of carbon-14 that you've got using the rates of production and the rate of decay in the equation. And using the present-day difference of about 30%, as being the difference between the rate of production and the rate of decay, you get that the length of time to accumulate the carbon-14 that's in the atmosphere today is only 10,000 years. This is assuming that you have an atmosphere with no carbon-14 in it to start with. You can get the amount of carbon-14 that's there today, that is here today, in 10,000 years. Now, if you had any nitrogen at all to start with in the atmosphere, you had carbon-14 produced from the beginning of the atmosphere. And about 80% at least of the atmosphere is nitrogen, so it's been around, apparently in rather large quantities, from the beginning. So I'm saying then you have an age for the atmosphere. If the atmosphere can't be any older than 10,000 years, how can any plant or animal be older than that? And how can fossils represent the remains of plants and animals older than 10,000 years, since they have to breathe? Well, here's the thing. This is a value assuming that the decay, that the difference has been constant in time. But if the difference has not been constant in time and the magnetic field has been decaying, this will bring the number down even more. So this is just assuming what the uniformitarian assumes, namely that the difference in the rate of production. Sure, yes, I'm just using his values for this. So using his values and saying that the difference in the two decay rates. When I said a few minutes ago 10 to 15%, I meant just on the best measurements that Libby had available. This is what it looked like. the saying 30 to 32% now doesn't mean that the difference has changed like that. It just means we have better measurements now to base or determine that difference. Libby had very scanty measurements at that time because rockets had not been sent up into the atmosphere and so forth in those days, and rocketry was just getting its start, and the sampling of the atmosphere and the study of the atmosphere is really just getting going good. So when I have given two sets of figures, I just meant with the best that Libby had to work with at that time. He said there was a difference of at least 10%. Now the measurements are much better, and they'd say it's closer to 30% difference in the two. But certainly probably the rate of production and the rate of decay has changed some due to this changing magnetic field. But this should bring the number down even more. I'm saying using that value, you get 10,000 years as the age of the atmosphere, which means nothing that breathes can be older than that, unless you want to postulate a loss of the atmosphere, a regaining of an atmosphere, and such things as that. Well, it's very hard to figure out how you can get an atmosphere back, or you can lose an atmosphere in the first place, since the gravitational pull of the Earth is 32 feet per second squared. And that's a rather large gravitational field. And certainly the temperature of the Earth's atmosphere, even in the outer reaches, doesn't seem to be high enough to even get rid of helium, which is a very light gas. Yes, if you have a stronger field, the concentration today should be larger than the concentration in the past, because it's coming in faster today. What you'd have to, of course, to really attack the problem to see if the rates of decay and production have changed in the past, you'd have to consider all the factors that might contribute to carbon-14 and nitrogen in the atmosphere. But using the figures of the uniformitarian, this is what it would indicate: an upper limit for the age of the atmosphere, 10,000 years, which puts a limit on your breathing. By the way, let me mention helium. I have a little bit more time here. Let me mention the helium in the Earth's atmosphere, since the subject has been mentioned by me. All profitable, maybe, in this matter. Helium occurs naturally in the crust of the Earth, crustal rocks of the Earth, and the helium pore usually is associated with natural gas wells, a lot of them in Texas. Helium pours out into the Earth's atmosphere. Then you have the decay of uranium into lead, and helium is one of the byproducts of this decay. When uranium, a radioactive mineral, decays into lead, helium is produced. When the geophysicist calculates the amount of helium that you should have in the atmosphere, he calculates the amount that is there, or determines it by taking samples with rockets from different levels in the atmosphere, he finds that you have only a millionth of the amount of helium in the atmosphere that should be present after 4.5 billion years of production of the helium by the various agencies. Now, different geophysicists have tried to figure out why is there not enough helium? Where is it gone? Because they've all believed just about that the age of the Earth is 4.5 billion years, and so they've been puzzled, where could the helium have gone? Where could all the helium have gone? When I first looked at this problem, about 15 years ago, it was suggested by Henry Norris Russell. You remember I mentioned him in regard to comets. Russell said, and the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram that I mentioned the first day, Russell, in his book The Origin of the Solar System, remarked on this, that there's not enough helium in the atmosphere. That's on about a millionth of what it should be, roughly like that. And he said, where could the helium have gone? And he figured that the helium atoms were colliding with metastable oxygen atoms in the upper atmosphere, and in those collisions, the helium atoms were getting enough energy that they could zip right out of the Earth's atmosphere and escape the gravitational pull of the Earth. Now, 15 years ago, this was the major suggestion as to how to get rid of that helium. They said, 4.5 billion years, you should have a million times more helium in the atmosphere than you have. Obviously, it's gotten away somehow, because things are this old. Well, I thought I would look into the problem, so I went through the calculations, which you can do very easily, of what the energy exchange would be in these collisions. Well, it turned out, at least, that there was no way to get rid of that helium, that the metastable oxygen atoms wouldn't give the helium particles nearly enough energy to escape from the gravitational pull of the Earth, reach the escape velocity that they'll have to get out of the Earth. Earth's gravitational pull. That has to be around 7 miles per second. That's a very high velocity, 7 miles per second. Well, I wrote a little paper on this, pointing this out, and pointing that this had, and I made my mistake when I followed the conclusion and wrote in the article, this puts a serious question on the radioactive dating methods, since they're suggesting 4.5 billion years, and this suggests only thousands of years to accumulate the amount of helium that's there, and there didn't seem to be any way to get rid of it. And I went through all the calculations involving these metastable atoms and so forth, oxygen atoms. I sent the paper to the American Journal of Physics, and after a few weeks, got the thing back. He'd sent it to some fellow up at Michigan State University, John, and this fellow wrote a letter back to me, and he said, "Oh, you're really mixed up." Said, "You ought to go and read James Jean's book on the kinetic theory of gases." He said, "Statistically, you can lose all of this helium as years go by." Well, I'd read the old Jean's book before I ever wrote the paper, of course, since you do want to know all the arguments that can be proposed against what you're saying. Well, I should have written back to him and asked him to do some reading, too. This Michigan State bird who sent my paper back, I don't like that a bit, what he did, as a matter of fact, because I went through the calculations myself, and all he had to do was go through them similarly. There is no way statistically you can lose a little bit of helium, because statistically a certain percentage, a very small percentage of the particles will always be at a high enough velocity for any gas, no matter what the gravitational pull of the planet is. But we weren't talking about a little trace of helium, a whiff of helium escaping. We were talking about a million times the amount that was in the atmosphere escaping. And this fella, so biased and so imbued with and enamored with the great ages of things, he couldn't see anything, and he sent the paper back. Well, I filed it away somewhere or other. I've lost it over the years, and have probably been thrown away or something. But about 10 years later, another man published an article on the same subject, Melvin Cook, that I've mentioned. He got his article coming to the same conclusions that I did. He got his article published, though, in Nature. I should have tried Nature myself. They're more open to controversial views than certain staid journals in this country. And I should have tried Nature way back then. But Cook got his published in Nature, and he came to the conclusion that you could account for all of the helium in the Earth's atmosphere in 10,000 years and maintain that there was no mechanism for the escape of the helium, and he got his article published in Nature. Of course, the moment that came out in print, his colleagues at the University of Utah began to set up a howl that you could hear clear to the Canadian border and back down to the Mexican border, crying and whining as if they were in mortal agony over such things as that. You get on this time question. These evolutionists can't stand the heat in the kitchen. Get on this time question. This really bothers them. If you want to make them angry, you talk about the time. As I told you in the first lecture, you can talk about nearly anything else and criticize them on it. But you hit that time question. That's like hitting a fellow in the nose where it really hurts. And that's when the agony sets in. That's when they really get angry. Well, Cook's troubles started at the University of Utah with the publication of that article, but he got his published. I wish they'd have published mine. Mine had preceded that by about 10 years. But the American Journal of Physics wouldn't publish mine because they said that couldn't be, and I really was ignorant of a number of things. Well, what I'm getting at is this. Gordon MacDonald down at UCLA, in a paper appearing in Reviews of Geophysics, re-examined this problem about 7 years ago. And he tried to find every mechanism, think up every mechanism he could for the escape of helium from the atmosphere. He went back to the metastable oxygen atom business that Russell had suggested. He looked at, he didn't bother to look at that because any physicist knew what genes had to say as to the percentage, and he didn't bother looking at that because everybody knows what that, couldn't even get rid of it. He examined the coupling of the Earth's magnetic field with the sun's magnetic field as a possible source. He looked at high temperatures existing on the outer edge of the Earth's atmosphere. as a possible source, but they're not high enough to get those particles up to a large enough velocity to get out of the atmosphere in the quantities they need. He examined every mechanism that had been dreamed up by somebody or by himself. And in the concluding part of his article, he said, we only have about a millionth of the amount of helium that we should, and nobody has been able to think of any mechanism for the escape of helium. So, it would seem that sometime or other, the obvious ought to become the obvious, and someone should conclude that the amount of helium that is in the Earth's atmosphere is the amount that should be there after only apparently several thousand years of decay of radioactive minerals and the pouring out of helium from the crust of the Earth into the atmosphere. Because when you use the amount that's there, Cook is pretty well right. 10,000 years is about the upper limit as to the length of time it would take to accumulate that helium in the atmosphere, assuming there were no helium to start with in the atmosphere. And you think sometime or other, someone would say, well, it's obvious. Well, of course, no one is going to do that, because it is the death knell again to the evolutionary ages that we've heard so very much about. Well, I have only 10 minutes to go. I think what I'll do is stop right here, and we'll start the uranium, lead, thorium, lead, and potassium, argon. We'll discuss those clocks tomorrow. That's all.